You don't need to work for everyone. You need to work out who are those people that bring you joy? Who are those people that aren't going to make you feel like you're always busy, that you've got time to really service them and use your skills the way that you wanted to when you started out?
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. It's Damien Greathead back with another episode of Strategy in the Virtual Controller. I'm here with my co-host, Penny Breslin. I'm sitting in Sydney, Australia. My co-host, Penny Breslin, sitting in San Diego. We're sort of deep in tax season right now. And we've also got a special guest who we'll introduce shortly. But Penny, how are you today?
Okay.
Revert back to that previous comment about deep in tax season.
Yeah, deep in tax season. Yeah. And all the other stuff that you have to do, regardless of whether or not it's deep in tax season.
And the funny thing is, just before we got started, we were just talking about the fact that there's no real non-busy season. And our guest, Amanda Gascoigne, just popped in and said, that is the most common thing I hear from all of the accounting firms that I work with. And so that's a perfect segue to introduce our wonderful guest, Amanda Gascoigne. Amanda, you're a little north of Sydney in Port Stephens. Majority of our listeners are based in the US. So tell us a little bit about yourself and tell us a little bit about Port Stephens.
Yeah. So, well, Port Stephens, an amazing part of the world. We sort of live in paradise. We had a holiday house here and we loved it so much. We actually made the sea change and moved here. So I had my practice an hour away. So I was just doing the commute, but absolutely love it. And it's really leans into what I am all about, is helping practice owners have better practices and better lives. And that's part of it. Yeah. And then
fantastic. I've been working with Amanda over the last couple of years and sort of learning how she's helping accounting firms. And I think she's doing some really amazing work from someone that's done it herself and made that transition herself. So Amanda, give us a little bit about your background. You're a chartered accountant by trade. And yeah, so tell us.
Chartered accountant. Chartered accountant. I'm now a fellow of chartered accountants and very proud chartered accountant. I started out my career in accounting, initially working as a research assistant for the professor of accounting at Newcastle University, but I always really wanted to go into public accounting. So I worked there for a couple of years and then I started a job as a graduate accountant at PwC, now known as PwC, in 1994. And then after that, I moved to a mid-tier firm about 18 months after that, where I stayed there until 1999, until I started out on my own. So pretty much 30 years this year in public accounting, effectively, when I start from that.
So in 1999, moving from a mid-tier firm to go out on your own, what was the sort of the impetus for that?
Yeah, well, in that first role, I learned all the trade. I learned all the technical stuff and I couldn't be happier with those managers and partners because it really showed me that attention to detail. But then with the second role, I was able then to build on that and that client relationship piece, which I am so passionate about. And I really think that's the business we're in. We're in the business of building client relationships. So those two melded together. I felt it was great for me to start on my own. The impetus actually was we wanted to start a family and there was no maternity leave policy at that mid-tier firm at that time. They wanted me to stay on and they wanted to provide some sort of policy for me, but I felt like I didn't want to be a guinea pig and be that first person to have that. I figured their idea of this flexible type of working arrangement perhaps was me getting all my work done in, my 5 days work done in 3 days. So I thought, no, I want to start on my own. And I did
It's so funny, isn't it? Just went, oh, you can work 3 days a week. I mean, we still expect you to get 5 days worth of work done, but you'll have the flexibility to work 3 days.
To work from home and be able to care for your new baby. And so I sort of thought about that and I just figured like, I'm much better off. I had the skills. I had the confidence in myself to back myself to go out and do that. And it was a big call to do that. And in those days, working from home was something that was really more for people who had a 9-to-5 job and then was doing something like a side hustle and they were working out of hours. So from an accounting perspective, it was people doing tax returns of an evening or on weekend. So it was quite new. And I know I used to get interviewed a lot about this working from home. And when I fell pregnant pretty much straight away and 9 months in, I had my first son and I think he was only about 5 days old and the local newspaper came and did a story on me, a working mom in business and with him on a sheepskin on my desk. So it was quite interesting. So I guess that also shows that I've always done things a little bit differently. I've been a little bit ahead of the curve in some things and really paved the way, I guess, for others to do things a little bit differently and but do it their way and in a way that's completely aligned with their goals and what they want from their lives and their version of success.
And sort of fast forward to your consulting role now, and you just sort of previewed it there slightly. What type of work are you doing currently now with accountants? Around the country and around the world.
So, yeah, I have clients in Australia and New Zealand currently. So I guess it's building all the things that I had to work out trial and error over those 18 years of having my practice, growing out of home, getting offices, getting staff, getting more clients and growing, but growing profitably. And I was the main breadwinner of our family and still am. And that's the choice that we had. So my husband was a stay-at-home dad with the two boys. And I guess I'm sharing all of the things that I did, the things that I navigated, the strategies that I implemented to actually achieve that balance. And it wasn't always rosy, I can tell you. And there was a lot of changing and I guess looking at different ways of doing things. But it was really like I knew that end goal. And I know that's the end goal for so many practice owners that decide to leave their safe, secure employment to really back themselves and do a business for themselves. But it's all really great at the beginning. And I think when you're really good at something, you having clients come and are naturally growing your firm can be quite easy for a lot of people, but it's managing that growth, which they often don't anticipate it's going to happen so quickly. Mm-hmm. So then we have problems with pricing, with growing and office space and staff and all of those things. So I guess that's a thing that I really help them get that better practice, better life, and get their version of what they want. Because everyone's different. And I think we need to really celebrate that not everyone wants $1 million practice. Some people want more flexibility. And I think it doesn't matter. And I think a lot of people feel like people are judging them from a success point of view, that if they don't want to get really big, why? But some people make that real conscious choice. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think it's interesting because I've seen incredibly profitable sole practitioners. I've seen not so profitable 10-person firms. It's really about that intention. But Penny, just before we started recording today's episode, you were just sharing an email that you got from a couple of accountants in Ireland. What was the background of that email?
The same exact same thing that Amanda's stating, as well as what we talked about when you said, how's it going? There is no end to the busy season anymore. And I think that there's a disconnect to what it is that people need and expect us to provide and what we used to provide in a after the fact regulated role that allowed us this amount of time to work on bookkeeping, accounting, non-tax related stuff. And then, okay, I'm going to shut that off. And now I'm going to go 3 months into taxes or whatever the country is. And these gentlemen I was speaking to in Ireland who contacted me through a mutual friend of us, Damien, that was exactly their problem.
Yeah.
And their lack of ability to hire good quality people to do work at prices that people were willing to pay. And kind of like I said, well, maybe you need to get rid of some of these people. They're not willing to pay the right price. And then at the same time, I also got contacted by a company in Argentina that has a U.S. operation, and they needed help. And I'm going, oh, you have more need of help than what I can give you. Yeah. So let me go find somebody who can get. And I explained to them the help they were going to need.
Yeah.
And he just came back to me, said, thank you for that lead. But basically, they're not willing to pay even on minimum rate.
Yeah.
And I said, good luck then with them, because they're already 3 months out of compliance on what's required for them by the United States government. Yes. And if you're not willing to do it at this guy's minimum rate, and I knew what the rate was, then something, good luck.
Yeah.
Good luck.
We have to, I think we've got to actually say that.
You have to say, not what I do. I'll find somebody who does do that. But if you want something that specific and that needed in your goals, what's it worth to you?
That's right. And I think because I think a couple of issues come up there is one, certainly the accountants I work with, they're amazing, lovely people. They've got such great heart and they want to help everyone. Mm-hmm. And they feel sorry for some people that have got themselves in a particular situation. And it tugs on our heartstrings. But But I think one of the best things there people can do is really set some boundaries about what that ideal client looks like. And it's not being harsh. It's actually being putting more of a commercial hat on is what I say. So I say you can be commercial and empathetic, but we just can't be like just giving. And I think, look, cracks were already appearing in practices prior to COVID, but people won't make as much profit as they wanted to. They were working extremely long hours. They weren't spending time with their family, all the things that they thought they were going to achieve when they went into practice. And COVID was pretty much the straw that broke the camel's back, because we started doing more things, giving clients a little bit more leeway, especially ones that were struggling. We're doing more for free. And what's happened is now our clients are expecting, they were expecting a lot before, but actually expecting even more. And how do we then pull back in a really empathetic, compassionate, but commercial way on some of those things, saying, look, we did a lot of those things during COVID, a lot of it as a goodwill gesture, but now the focus needs to be back on myself, on my family, going back to where I started my practice and really resetting. And I think a new calendar year or a new financial year is the perfect opportunity to actually do just that.
I agree with everything Amanda said. And there's another part of this that adds into it, and it did come out because of COVID, but I agree with her also that this was inevitable. That these businesses, especially, and people cannot find the typical person they would hire as a new hire to come in and then train them up within their company to take care of a lot of the issues. And again, that's because they tended to bring in lower paid, lower educated people and train them up. So they're looking to accounting people and people who understand business finance to help them with that. Not realizing that maybe, or not caring, one or the other, that they too have to go out and find these people and train them up. And then they're taking on the cost and ownership of that employee. So when you are asking the accountant or bookkeeper firm to do this work for you, you're off-putting all your operational and overhead cost of an employee onto them. So they have to add that into what they were charging before.
Yeah.
And the thing is, they're supposed to give you a little bit faster service, maybe a little bit more clarity. And they're the one who are doing the training. So you get hopefully better information. So that's the trade-off. But also you get specifically what you need as that owner of a business.
Yeah.
And it's not easy. I don't know about in Australia, but certainly here in the United States, trying to find somebody who's willing to come in at a low level when, especially like here in California, when flipping a burger will make you $22 an hour.
Yeah. And
a bookkeeper's going to make what, 17 if she's lucky?
Yeah. And that's the thing, that when people go out on their own and then they grow and they need to get staff, their pricing, their formative pricing isn't sufficient to actually then bring on those extra overheads, like extra subscriptions for every one of their software.
Yes.
You know, a lot of things to consider. So what I speak to clients, especially starting out on their own, we actually look a little bit at that at the end game. So actually budgeting for that potential new person, new other resources, new software, and actually starting at that point. So you'll make possibly a little bit more profit at that stage, but we've got it built in. We don't need to go and change our prices too quickly, because I do think people underestimate how quickly they can grow and then need that additional resource, or even going from a certain level of income to the next level. And what I'm seeing is when people need to get staffing, sometimes those staff members are costing more than the owner is paying themselves.
Oh, quite often. And do you think also, Amanda, that when people are starting out, so, and again, you go back to 1999 when you started out yourself and you thought, well, you know what? I can do it for half the price. So I'll be able to pick up as many clients as I need. And since I'm operating out of home, I can do it really cheaply. So that'll be my competitive advantage is I can do it for cheap. And I think unfortunately,
I didn't do that. Oh, no. And it's so funny, because looking back at all this, I wonder why I did certain things the way I did them. I guess one, I was a chartered accountant, and I knew the value and I knew what I brought to the table. So that was one reason I didn't do that. I knew that in sort of the near future, I would have moved out to offices. And that actually basically came at about the 2 year mark that I went and just hired an office. So I basically, when I was looking at my pricing, I did factor a lot of that stuff in. because then I didn't want to have to then go and then up my prices to cover that new cost of having an offer, security, et cetera. And then clients say, oh, that's all we're paying for. Amanda's new flash office.
Amanda's fancy office.
You know, and I had that in my mind from the outset.
Wow. Yeah.
So I remember my boss at the time when I said I was leaving, I was going to have all these, I did have some ideas that I thought I might work on a Saturday morning and I'll get some more clients like that. And he said, Amanda, like, I would really encourage you to think differently about that, because if you have a baby and then by the time they're four or five, they're going to be involved in weekend sports. And then at that point, you're going to have to pull back and say, oh, no more Saturday appointments. And then I'm going to have all these people cross with me for doing that. Mm-hmm. And the thing was, the way you start will be the way you finish. And I really remember that quote, and I still, to this day, I share it with people, because even when I set up clients' businesses, I guess I was thinking about that, but just always thinking about that future and what you want it to look like, and not to do things now, maybe for that competitive advantage or for the wrong reason. Like, let's look at all this stuff commercially. We're the best at numbers that anyone can find. Let's factor some of those things in. So I guess my competitive advantage was that I was small. I offered a personalized service. Being homing from home, I had clients coming to me with their kids at times. My clients knew I was going to have a baby there, so they actually accepted that. So that was part of that. That was part and parcel if they came to me. And I guess I talk a lot about client selection, and I help a lot of my clients reset their client basis and be quite picky and choosy getting their ideal clients. And even though I didn't have that written down anywhere, I think I was, because I really was welcoming people into my home. So I was quite picky in the clients that I took on. I wanted them to ensure that for me, family was my biggest.
You're not inviting the riffraff into the
room. No, I didn't. And I was careful where I advertised, Damien, because no sign out the front, no things that people could. I didn't want people just coming to my house. So having those good quality clients, guess what? They refer more good quality clients that have got similar ideas.
Similar values,
And that's what I work with clients on now, right now. So a lot of things to think about with that pricing, and not to undercut and really use the commerciality and that we're so good for other clients for ourselves.
And it's sort of a really interesting comment there that you made in terms of you help clients reset their client base. So I'd imagine you probably have a small client base that are startup and they can sort of from the get-go, they can start that way. But I know a lot of your accounting firm clients are also established firms. How do you help them reset their client base?
Great question. And currently my Better Practice, Better Life program, that's part of the program. And I had a gentleman, he said to me on the very first call, I'm probably the oldest client, the oldest person doing this course. He said, I'm 60. I've had my practice for 20 something years, but like the light bulb moments by some of the things that I'm discussing and getting them to think about, he said, it's just changed my whole perspective. And one of those is ideal clients. So when I look at an ideal client and I get my clients to go and look at their client base, we do a number of things. One, we look at the numbers and I look to see what clients are, tier out your clients. How many clients do you have under $1,000, under $2,000, and then significantly those tiers above that. Just to get a bit of an idea on the makeup. And what we often find is the lowest 10 or 20% of our income is actually coming from 80% of our clients, who are actually, a lot of them can be quite headachey, quite needy. And it's actually stopping.
Pareto's principle.
Yeah, it is. Stopping to do that. And I guarantee the people that do this exercise, they look at it and it literally comes out all the time like that. And they're sort of, it's the opportunity cost of them spending all this time down the bottom. The people that are willing to pay, that are already their higher average fee per client, they're waiting in the wings for people to do more advisory services. That's one piece that we've got the numbers to show us that. The second thing that I do is that I get my clients to do a couple of exercises. One is for them to sit down with their teams, if they've got teams, and articulate what are the characteristics of a good client. What are the characteristics of a poor client? So that really like starts to make you think, and you can, I guess, resonate with who those clients, particularly even client names. And then the other thing that I do is I look at the marketing concept, where we look at really the whole client base as a, what are the demographics of them? What are their behaviors, the psychographic and the geographic? I use that marketing principle, and all of those things, it's like, now I know why I love dealing with Jill over here. And why Jane over here really like zaps my energy, and I come out of the meeting all like not feeling great. And I go home and I'm thinking about all these issues that she said, and it's like zapping my energy, costing me money. And they're the ones that are ringing us up all the time. So it really then allows them to reset the client base and to work out, like, who do I really want to work with? So I had a client yesterday and they said, oh, we could do this and we could do that. And I said, just remember, you only want to work 4 days a week. So you've got 30 hours. Do you have enough time to do this and this? You've got to choose. And I have another person doing the course who's just starting out. And oh my goodness, every time he jumps on a call, he I've worked out my ideal client. Their average fee needs to be at least $5,000. And I want to do this service and this service and that's it. And he's just so super clear. So there's a couple of little tricks there that you can do, but it's really, the thing is, you don't need to work for everyone. You need to work out, who are those people that bring you joy? Who are those people that aren't going to make you feel like you're always busy, that you've got time to really service them and use your skills the way that you wanted to when you started out?
Penny, it sort of reminds us of chapter one of the book. It's not just the numbers, doesn't it?
That, no, it does. And then we'll have to get you a copy.
Who do you want to work with? Penny
yeah. Wrote. I think it's nice to have, I like the way I teach and the way that I empower and encourage my clients is by using a little bit of a mixture of the number side of things, but also things that are relevant perhaps for other industries. And that's the way I've always learned. So whilst I love going to the accounting conferences and different things, I have always taken inspiration from different industries, perhaps industries that so far removed from accounting, but ones that might be over the years have been really big on culture or really big on client service. And I've used all those different industries, going to lots of women's events, lots of, really things to help me have that growth mindset that I can bring into practical experience that I actually experienced when I was in practice, plus a lot of the other stuff. So I think that was what makes me a little bit different, because I've got all those little, so I'm not your typical, I was never your typical accountant and I'm not your typical coach.
And I think there was, two things there that you said. The first one that sort of caught my ear was, what brings you joy? And I don't think, certainly there's not a lot of the consultants out there, or you're not reading on Accountants Daily or Accounting Today, too many articles about how accounting work brings joy to people. But also what I did love as well is that client that said they had this long list of ideas of everything that they wanted to do. And you said, well, hang on, what was really important to you was working 4 days a week.
Yeah.
30 hours in 4 days a week.
Yeah.
So really bringing it back to, what were the key things that you set out to with this business or whatever it is? And great ideas, but you've only got 30 hours in the week.
Yeah, okay? Going back to that vision. And I talk from experience, because I also, when I was in accounting, I also did some qualifications to become a financial planner as well. So I thought, isn't this great? I could actually offer two lots of services. I've got this ideal client base that really need good financial planning. Let's do both. And shortly into it, I think I did it for about 18 months. And I was still learning the ropes, and I don't like to do anything unless I feel really comfortable. And it was I actually can't do both. I really can't. As much as I love the idea of having the additional income, being able to service my clients even better, I just literally could not do it if I was really true to my values about wanting to spend as much time with my family as I could. I just couldn't do it. So I then made the decision, after doing all that, investing my time, energy and money into that, it wasn't the right thing. So
can I ask you a question? Did you at that time, because you obviously, if you invested that much in your education and learning about it, would have known somebody that are being able to find somebody who could do that?
Yes, I did.
And wanted to do that, but didn't want to do the part you want to do.
Yes, yes. So, yeah, I guess I had a couple of financial planners that I had really great relationships with, and then I just referred that out. And again, a lot of people saying, well, that's actually money I'm giving away when I could be doing it.
Not really, because they're referring back to you, aren't they?
Yeah, it's that cross-referral thing happening anyhow. And I think stick to your knitting, stick to the stuff that you really love. And I think particularly with a lot of small and solo accounting practice owners, we really can niche with a lot of our services. Everyone needs, pretty much all of them. We really can niche and deliver an exceptional service to our clients, a lovely mix of compliance and advisory services. We can do that, but that's for 20 plus years. And we're still hearing the same conversations that we want to get out of the grind so we don't have all these deadlines, that we can do all these great things, business planning, budgeting, tax planning, but people find they just don't have enough time. So we've got to actually make the time. And to do that, we need to reset completely. Reset in line with our vision, who our clients are, what our services are, and really what we want to be known for.
Do you find that when it comes to the Tide Pod back in the day, and I know back in the 90s, I When I was pregnant with my son, the day I found I was pregnant, the Wall Street Journal had an article about they were thinking about giving women 6 weeks off maternity leave, considering it at the time. Yeah. Which is why I ended up going remote back in 1987. But if you look back at how we used to track our time and bill for our time, we tracked basically the amount of time we spent actually doing data entry back then on paper and then and on computers.
Books, coding.
Right. But now, what we didn't track was that time it took us to think about the right way to do it or think about the answer to come up with to cap the solution for the client. We were just billing them for the time we were actually in doing that data entry. And now the data entry, a lot of it is being done or smoothed out through apps. But it also requires us to even expand the way we think and look at a project because we're getting all that information a lot quicker. And so decisions have to be made faster. And then decisions also have to change quicker because other things are happening faster. So we have to switch from billing on that data entry transaction level time to how are we going to bill for the value of our money?
Yeah, absolutely. And that then, if I still advocate the use of timesheets, like I never stopped. I know there was the big trend to
never stop
timesheets. I never, ever, that's one thing that one trend I didn't jump on. I did fixed fee pricing. So at the beginning of the year, I would issue proposals, engagements with a fixed fee. But I still kept my time to see whether that fixed fee was appropriate. I always honored that fixed fee, but I had to then realize that if I was taking more time or my staff were taking more time or that client became more needy for whatever reason, I needed to then re-engage and re-quote. And that timesheet piece allowed me to do that really confidently. And again, that's one of the things that I work with my clients. I think you're going to have to start using timesheets again. And they often don't like that because the minute they start their practices, like timesheets in the bin, we'll never see you again. But that's responsible. But that actually is one of the things that's responsible for profitability reducing.
Absolutely.
And one of my clients who started using timesheets and did nothing else with that, 30% extra in his income.
Really?
Capturing his time. Yeah. So we thought, because I love doing things about the book. And so like I made sure that I had if I was working a full day, 7.5 hours, and I made sure, and if it was non-chargeable, I wanted to know where I was spending my non-chargeable time because that also could give me clues whether I needed to hire more staff, whether I should delegate more. And I realized, but a lot of practice owners just say, I'm just going to put my chargeable time down, but they don't realize.
We track billable and non-billable time.
Yeah, I agree.
I want to know how much time we're spending on trying to figure things out.
Yeah.
That we're not putting a client tab because we need to figure that out.
We do need to involve and to change our processes, Penny.
Yes,
the
exactly.
Thing there, I think the difference in what we used to do, so we used to have everything tracked and then we just multiplied by our charge out rate. And people remember what their charge out rate was when they worked for someone else. So maybe they use that same charge out rate. But like you said, some of that work that we were doing before is now gone. And the work that we're now doing is a lot higher level. So do we then need to actually increase that charge out rate? We don't need to actually be disclosing charge out rates to clients because we're actually just using that as a guide to come up with the appropriate price based on what it's costing and then that value that we're providing. But I think a lot of people are still staying at historical rates that probably aren't correct, where they might be better off using a hybrid rate. And the other thing they're forgetting is that things are taking us quicker time because of the technology we're using, but they're forgetting to then somehow package into that price the cost of software because that's
learning software and training and notification.
It's potentially saving us another staff member, potentially. Yeah. But where we're looking at the cost to deliver that service, somehow we forget all those other, we're just thinking, oh, that's an overhead, where it actually is a cost that we should be recovering because it is. So, what I find that the more technology we've been implementing, which I've been great, I love technology. I became a paperless office in 2008, which was very early. I love technology, but we also need to be keeping our finger on the pulse with our numbers to make sure that the benefactors of that technology is us and not our clients. Because what I'm seeing is it's the client. So, all those cost savings, as people think, cost savings from time are going straight to the client. And then they're basically absorbing a lot of that overhead.
It's funny, isn't it? Because if there was a person sitting in a chair doing all that work and filing the paper and all that type of stuff, you'd be very conscious of the cost of it.
Correct.
And sort of technology whirring in the background. Mandy, quick one, just in terms of category, and I think you do this, Penny. In terms of categorizing your non-billable time, is it just non-billable or are you breaking it down into admin training?
No, I break it down.
Break it down
to everything. We don't have a
marketing, marketing, admin, preparation of particular campaigns and things. I had it all broken down. And in fact, I had a group coaching session last week in beautiful Byron Bay. And that was one of the things that I shared with my coaching clients, my full list of time codes that we used to use, which I think people like are newer to the industry don't actually have this, what we actually used to do. It's they don't know any different. They don't know that they've got to do that stuff, but they don't know if they track those, it's going to tell them such a great story and allow them to make better decisions. So yeah, definitely all that non-chargeable. And I've got a timesheet template that I work off and I get my clients to work off, and it has that non-chargeable broken down so we can see.
I do it the same thing on that pricing time where we price out a cost of an engagement. You also have time, especially if you're a one person or if you're a multi-person business, where you have to discuss the client. Mm. And if you're talking about where we're going to move, what the problems are, what are the blocks on the client, how has the client changed? And you have meetings about it. And it's non-chargeable time. But I said, no, add that in there. Everybody who's in the room, what is their hourly cost to be in the room? Break it up by the number of clients you're going to discuss and add that cost onto your flat rate.
Yes.
Because here's the thing is, if you don't, you won't have the meeting. And if you don't have the meeting, you'll lose information on how to deal with that client.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I think out of all those things, like it's actually stepping back and thinking, what's it costing to run my practice? What is my available capacity? So if we just even look at a charge out rate, even though we might hopefully get more than our charge out rate because we're doing a more value based, but let's just say at a minimum, people should be looking at and comparing their current fees with what's the charge out rate? How many available hours do they have a year? And their productivity percentage, like, well, how does that compare to what they're getting? And quite often they're leaving money on the table because they're not capturing that time. They're either not billing. So that's a minimum, because I think people can achieve far greater than that when they're doing more value-based pricing for certain services.
I think you have to be intentional, like you said, because if you are doing a value-based service, you are using your mind more.
Yeah.
You're not using the keystrokes.
No.
And so you have to allow yourself the space within your own head to be able to perform it well.
Yes.
And you're right, a 30-hour work week, that's 30 hours of billable time, or is that 30 hours combined of billable and non-billable?
That 30 hours was both. So they have to be. And I think what happens is that Parkinson's law theory, the more time we have, the more time we'll use. And I think that's what's happening for a lot of practices. Like, I can do this on the weekend. So then their 40-hour week becomes 70 hours. And like, so I think I really love, and I think as part of our talent issue, we need to actually change our practices so we are actually attractive. Like, if we're actually talking to people in the community or friends at a barbecue and we're saying we're so stressed, a done deadline after another, like all this, and I've got so much work to do, I've got to leave early, and they've got a friend who wants to do accounting, are we actually making it really attractive for them to come in? So we do have to embrace some of these new ways, whether they're a compressed week or whether they are a four-day work week. But the people that are actually doing that, they're actually finding they're getting greater productivity because people are more focused. So I think that more focusing, whether we're focusing on the clients we're working on, the tasks we're working on, our own practices, that's the key, I believe.
And so I think you also understand priorities better.
Yes, you know? I think. Yeah.
I actually use technology to help me with that. Yes. I set do not disturbs starting at a certain time on a Friday afternoon.
Yeah.
And it doesn't shut off until Monday morning. So if you want something that has to do with work.
I love the out of office.
Give me.
Out of office do not disturb. I think they are really handy. And I would really encourage people not to be so available, because that availability thing is also working against that value-based thing. People have to wait for our time. People can't expect immediate.
You mean we're not the Amazon of accounting?
Yeah. So I think we have to then work out that this is sacred time to me, my family time. And I have pretty much for a long time only worked a 4-day work week. In my office, we had a 4.5-day. So we closed at 12:30 every Friday. My staff loved it. I became an employer of choice by doing that. And clients just got used to it. I think it's the way you communicate these things. And that's why I said about really embracing what you want, because you can actually do it. You've just got to communicate it.
Well, and I think also the other thing is, more often than not, that query that comes in from a client on a Saturday doesn't need to be solved on a Saturday, but it's because the client had a bit of extra headspace to actually think about what's going on in their business and they asked that question. And I, even just in my own, with my own team, it is my work day. It's sort of like once sort of 4:30 comes along and I've got to head out to daycare to pick Gus up, I'm offline from about 4:30 till 7:30. Or even till about 8:30 after dinner, but I might pop back on if an email's come in and I'll reply to it or send something to my team. I've been very clear with my team to say, if I send you an email, unless there's like an urgent something in the, the subject, I'm not expecting a reply until tomorrow. And I think that's the same thing to your point about availability. Good customer service is not replying to a client email within 30 minutes. It's replying with good quality information. It's replying at a time. It's meeting their expectations and exceeding their expectations. And so I think just because a client's sending you an email on a Saturday doesn't necessarily mean that they need an answer on a Saturday. But if they do, make sure you've set that up, set that expectation up with your client to say, we'll reply within 24 hours or business. If there is something urgent, just put it in the header so that we know that we can prioritize it. And it's just about, again, setting those expectations with the client, asking what's important to the client, and then that's certainly going to help you deliver on it. Because I think, unfortunately, the accounting profession, it's got a bit of a bad brand. I'm not sure if brand's the right word, but you don't see people flocking into public accounting like you do some of the other industries. No. But it doesn't have to be that way, because there's good money to be made. There's good
money, rewarding.
Yeah.
We're needed, and we're going to be even more needed.
That's so much value to add, offer.
All these people that are going to be retiring, these practice owners that are going to be retiring soon, and the people that we're not getting as many people in. So we're going to become even more valuable. When I went into practice, like, that's when I thought everyone needs an accountant. It was something that I could do full-time, part-time. There was always going to be work. And it is such a really rewarding industry.
And compliance is just one part of that, a very important part of it. But the ability... what I loved working in an accounting firm was seeing accountants solving complex problems for their clients. Some of those problems were compliance. Some of those problems were just understanding the business better and understanding the numbers better. And the accountants need space to be able to think critically and think creatively for their clients. They don't necessarily need another tax return to pay the bill. But I think there's some really exciting opportunities for accountants to add a whole lot of value to small, medium-sized businesses around the world. And they just need to, not just need to, but freeing the space up to enable
they
them
need
to do that.
To create capacity to be able to do that. Yeah. So I love tax planning. So the way that I worked, I tried to get most of my, all of my lodgements, everything, more my workflow was scheduled from July through to for the first sort of 8 months of our financial year. And everyone was given a month. And then from there on in, it was time for me to do tax planning for the good quality clients to ensure that I had everything covered before year end, and also to do my own planning. So if we wanted to implement some new software, or we wanted to change some processes and workflow plan and quote for the next year, we had plenty of time to do that. So here in Australia, we have lodgement statistics, like lodgement expectations from the tax office. And a lot of people get really annoyed by that. But I like to think of that as, think of it differently. Like, I don't want to get 85% of my returns done by the end of the year, because that means I'm letting down 15% of my client base. I want to actually aim to have all of them done. And the people that I can't get done, it maybe that they're the ones that are holding me up. Maybe they're not the right clients.
Exactly.
Like, I think I like to look at that in a different way. So that would be one thing that I would actually, you know, any of those things that are getting you down, or the things that you're thinking, I'm about to throw in the towel, I don't want to do this anymore, I think they're our greatest gifts. Because what we can do and say, well, how can we fix this? Can we eliminate this? Can we, whether it's a change in behavior or a change of what we expect from our clients or whatever. But I think using those things, or when there's a mistake made, How can we implement a new process? Could we have a software that can automate this and it wouldn't happen, wouldn't slip through the cracks? So I think when you're actually in that despair and thinking, I don't really love this anymore, think about how you can do that differently and maybe brainstorm with other colleagues, because I'm sure everyone is experiencing some of those issues that you're having, or get coach, mentor, and go and do some further learning. Because I know that the majority of people I speak to, they dearly love accounting and there isn't anything they really want to do. So when I dive deep and say, look, if this is really one out, like what else would you do? And at the end of the day, I would say the vast majority still love clients. They love accounting. They love helping clients, but they just need to reset what they're doing so they can achieve what they set out at the beginning. And then some others, they got into accounting by a bit of a mistake. They were forced into it by someone and they've actually got something completely different. And for those people, I say, go for it. We have one life. Let's live it and make sure that everything is actually working for us. So that's probably a bit of a takeaway, because I think we can learn from those stressful moments.
Yeah, love it. And I think that's probably a really good place. Again, whenever we have a guest on, Amanda, typically we could charge on for another 45 minutes.
Of course, I know.
But that this has been a really interesting conversation, Amanda. And I think it really aligns with what Penny's building in Chennai and the work that Penny and I both do with accounting firms, and obviously what you do with accounting firms in helping them be more intentional about the practice and the business that they're trying to build. Amanda, how do people find out more information about you? People find you?
They can go, I'm on all the socials. So I'm on all the social channels, you know, LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram, Amanda Gascoigne. And I also have two websites, amandagascoigne.com and The Balanced Firm, which is my community for small and solo accounting practice owners wanting a better practice, better life.
I'm going to send you an email and I'm going to ask you for a headshot and those links so I can get them put up on this.
Certainly, but a few of those resources that I spoke about, the leaving money on the table, that's all available free on the website. So if anyone's wanting to be curious to see how their fees are going compared to what they could be making if they were a little bit more intentional looking at the numbers closer, that's on the website. There's also that timesheet template on there, but there's quite a few free resources on there as well as some paid ones.
I mean, I think even I'd imagine a number of US accountants would be really interested just to see how they compare with their Australian counterparts, for sure.
Well, also, I'm sure that it's formula based. So
it's all formula based. It's just a little PDF. It's just a PDF.
So it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. So it's just a PDF. You can, euros, I've got the dollar signs, but anyone that's from whatever currency, just pop those details.
And I could tell you, after speaking with you, speaking with Ireland, and speaking with Argentina, just in 1 week, same issues across.
Yes. It's universal, Penny. Yes. It is actually universal. But universally, we can, and as a collective, we can actually change this.
That would
and
be nice.
I think we really can change the way that we work with our small business and business clients, and really resetting that engagement with them, their expectations, what we expect of them, and really do that for the good of everyone.
Brilliant. Awesome.
Amanda, this has been fantastic. I love chatting with you, whether it's on a podcast or when we catch up at different conferences and at different events. So I look forward to our next conversation together. Hopefully you'll come back and join us on the podcast again another time. We'll get the links on the website into the podcast, but you can Google or look for Amanda on LinkedIn, Amanda Gascoigne. Surname is pronounced spelled GASCOIGNE, Amanda Gascoigne. You'll be able to find her on LinkedIn, connect with her there. But obviously, we'll include the links in the podcast. Amanda, thank you very much. It's been a delight to learn more about what drives you and how you're helping firms around the country and around the world. Penny, pleasure as always, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you. Thank you, Amanda.
Thanks so much, Penny and Damien, for having me on your podcast.
Absolute pleasure.